Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch movies we probably should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Joining me for the first time ever, fellow Nerd Party member, Darren Moser. Darren, I am so excited you are here today. Thank you so much for being on the show.
This here's a bottomless pit, baby. 2.5 miles straight down.
You're quoting The Core, right? The Core, the great movie.
No, dear God, no, no. That jeez, oh man, that movie.
We should just start the whole episode over. This is a terrible way to start off any episode.
I mean, we have both watched that, I'm assuming, but we're not going to be talking about the Core. We're not quite going that deep, but that's okay. Doesn't mean it's not a deep film, but we're not going quite that deep. So, but no, thanks for having me on. I'm really excited. This was a bit in the making because, as some people know, I was a film major, and so there's a lot of films that I have seen. And so it was difficult to come up with one that I had not seen. So today, I think you're in the hot seat of not having seen this week's movie.
Exactly. And this is great. We are doing The Abyss, which is almost, I want to say, the forgotten James Cameron movie, if we're not counting Piranha 2.
Ooh,
but as far as I feel like this came out like right in the middle of James Cameron's, like, he did Terminator, he did Aliens, and then no one really talks about The Abyss, and then Terminator 2, and True Lies, and from that point on, then he has a million Oscars. So I've never seen The Abyss. It was perfect when you brought this up, because you were telling me this is one of your favorite movies, if not your favorite.
Yeah, it's kind of a standard when you're a film major that you have to have a favorite film, which is really difficult. And so often, I mean, it's like this movie and Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars is on a whole nother level.
Right.
But I would often answer with The Abyss as my favorite film. I really, really enjoyed it. And I'd get that, you know, what's that movie? You know, I mean, it's not like 12 Angry Men or, you know, Gandhi or something like that. But it's a really great film that, as a Cameron fan, which it sounds like you are, I think you're going to enjoy.
Yeah. And Darren, so like I said, we're both on the Nerd Party, and you have a couple shows on the Nerd Party. You have City Alpha 3 and then Goodnight Moon, which we were talking about before the show is on a hiatus, but they're both fantastic shows. Tell the people at home about these shows and why they should listen to them immediately, but not before you listen to this episode. Go listen to this first.
This isn't a spoiler type show in the fact that you need to pause just because you haven't listened to all of our Star Trek talk. So yes,
exactly.
I do the Star Trek episode on the Nerd Party Network called City Alpha 3 with my two co-hosts, Philip Gilfus and Daniel Prue. Same trio that came over from Earl Grey back in the day. So I think collectively we've definitely gone over 200 episodes of talking Trek at this point.
That's amazing.
And what's great about this show, it's a general Trek show, so we can talk about all of Star Trek. And right now we are exclusively reviewing the Star Trek Discovery episodes that are airing at this time, but we do enjoy talking about all aspects of Star Trek. It's great because the three of us like different things about Star Trek, and so we get a really good dynamic that's, you know, stood the test of time at this point, going really well. My other show is Goodnight Moon, which I record with my daughter, who is 5, and that's been on a little hiatus since last January, but we're actually gearing up for some new episodes. Basically, it's a kind of a stylized 15, no, actually, it's like 10 minutes and under. It's really short, but it's just, I just started recording our conversations as she was getting ready for bed, and it's really mellow, and we're just talking about science and space, and I really want to expose her to those passions that I have, and it's adorable. It is
adorable is the best word, and I was telling you before the show, and I want to make sure everyone who listens to this episode hears this, but my wife Sarah, who is also co-hosted on Missing Frames with me, when I was telling her, I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to be doing an episode with Darren for Missing Frames. And she was like, Darren, what shows does he do? And I told her about City Alpha 3. And then I told her about Goodnight Moon. And she put Goodnight Moon on because she was like, oh my god, that sounds adorable. And she's literally, I think even right now as we record this, she's listening to Goodnight Moon and just sobbing at her computer. And I keep walking into the room and she's like, it's so adorable. So there's a ringing endorsement for that. But yeah, so I mean, these podcasts are fantastic, Darren. And there's so many great podcasts you should be checking out at thenerdparty.com. Make sure you're following us at Join Nerd Party on Twitter. And then like the Facebook page. It's just The Nerd Party. Do all of that stuff and give us all the 5-star ratings you could possibly imagine. But let's get to The Abyss. So, Darren, tell me about your history with this movie. Like you said, it's funny you bring up film school talking about, like, you know, Star Wars and The Abyss. Those were your go-to favorite movies when people would ask. I feel like it's great to have... I went to film school as well, and I felt like the more I said Star Wars or The Lord of the Rings was my favorite movie, the more like I felt like I had to have another movie in my back pocket, because that's what everybody says.
You have to have your
like,
hipster,
you know, it's
movie,
like,
that no one heard of that you have to pull
exactly.
out.
You have to get that pretentious kind of film snobbery in so you don't feel like you're just like, oh, you like Star Wars? You're so mainstream. So
I like Star Wars, but it's based on Kurosawa and his work. It's really derivative of the fourth
Kurosawa.
Movement of film. Yeah, exactly.
What, is there a more obvious Japanese filmmaker out there?
Oh, yeah, my history with The Abyss. So obviously it came out in 1989, right between Aliens and Terminator 2. And I was a little young for watching that, but I'm pretty sure I watched The Abyss probably in the mid-90s for the first time. It was probably a Blockbuster grab. That was a store, kids, that had movies. You didn't have to buy them. It's kind of like Netflix, but you physically had to go pick them up. And but in 2000, they released, 20th Century Fox released a series of DVD special packs called 20th Century Fox Special Collector's Editions. And disc number one was The Abyss in this beautiful case. It had all these behind-the-scenes features, and it was two discs. And they've since released, you know, like Alien and Aliens and, you know, Fight Club. A lot of their, you know, really good kind of action sci-fi films. So when I picked that up in 2000, that just rekindled my love for this movie. So much so that it influenced some films that I made. I made one or two student films. They are student films. I'm just putting that up front when I was going to university. And so I made a little short film called The Pod has a submarine, and it uses models and green screen and sets, which are all three things that we hadn't done at the school before. So I'm very influenced by this film. But beyond the fact that I feel it's just a really good film. It's really well acted. It's at that era with, you know, it has one of the first uses, actually the first use of CGI water. But
yes, I was going to say that's one of the few things I know about this movie. Okay. Is that there is a CGI water face in it. And it was almost a precursor to the T-1000 and Terminator 2 in a way.
Yes, exactly. That technology directly went into the making of the liquid metal T-1000. So before I get too much into it, what do you know about The Abyss?
That is the thing I know about The Abyss. I know next to nothing about this movie. I mean, I know it takes place, you know, they're in a submarine. I think it's quasi-futuristic. I don't know anything about this movie. It's amazing. This is one of three James Cameron movies I haven't seen. I haven't seen Piranha 2, sadly. And I haven't seen True Lies, and then I haven't seen The Abyss. And The Abyss is the one that holds the most interest for me. And it's always one that I've been like, oh yeah, I should see that. That looks fascinating. I mean, anything submarine-wise, anything that, like, is underwater for some reason holds a strong fascination for me. It's, like, super creepy. There's something, like, beautiful about, like, just the sheer expanse of the ocean and this whole world that we don't even know. So the idea and the concept of this movie has been very appealing to me. And I'm basically taking the long-winded route of telling you that I know there's a water face in this movie, and that's it. That's all I know.
Well, first off, I'm going to put dibs on True Lies, because that's another film that I really enjoy.
Yes,
so
we should do
I
that.
I need to come
that
back
awesome.
For that. We'll get the Cameron double bill. Well, I'm about to put you through the Abyss School because when we were discussing this, I said, well, which version do you want to watch? Because there's the theatrical version, which runs 145 minutes, and there's the special edition, which adds like a half hour to the movie. It's approaching the Last Jedi territory.
That sounds par for the course for James Cameron. All his special editions that go from like, it's a two-hour movie that becomes a three-hour movie.
Yeah, it's 171 minutes long in the special edition.
Wow.
So, but I recommend the special edition, which is the one we're going to watch, mostly
right.
because they took a lot out of the third act, and it's a lot, and it kind of has a lot of payoff and explanation that I think is important. And okay. obviously, why not watch more Abyss when you can?
why not really get into the abyss of the abyss?
Exactly. And then, if we have time to talk about it, I also lent you my copy of the Under Pressure Making of the Abyss, which if you are a cinephile, which it sounds like
yes.
you are.
Yeah, I'm absolutely going to make an effort to watch that too, because that I'm sure is fascinating.
It's one of my favorite documentaries. I would say the Lord of the Rings documentaries are slightly above it, but it, again, was one of those documentaries that inspired me to go into film school and to, you know, to try my hand at filmmaking. So and it's a really good documentary of the making of the movie, which
yeah.
after you see the movie, I think you'll want to enjoy. So there's a lot to digest. I'm asking like a quarter of a day worth of watching. It feels
I know, this
like.
Better be worth it. This better be worth it. I better love this movie. And as far as James Cameron goes, how do you feel about James Cameron? Because I feel like, I think undisputably he's one of the great filmmakers of all time. But I feel like, I don't know why, but I feel like I have to put an asterisk next to that. And it's only because of his more recent film, Avatar and
right.
Titanic. I feel like it's so unfortunate that we have to be like, James Cameron's amazing, and people like are like, are you crazy? And it's like, well, no. I mean, Aliens, Terminator.
Titanic is like, still pretty amazing. Like, the scope
yeah,
of
Titanic,
it.
Yeah, Titanic, it is an incredible achievement. Same thing for Avatar,
right.
Regardless of how you feel about the movies themselves, the content.
I mean, Pocahontas in space, but I mean, let's, you know,
but
Dances
come
with Wolves
but, like,
in space, yeah.
So do you feel like, have you talked... Is if you were to talk to people and they were like James, like they'd only seen Avatar or they'd only seen Titanic and they were like, oh, James Cameron, what is The Abyss the movie you'd recommend to them? Or would you recommend something else like Terminator or Aliens?
I would probably recommend Aliens as a
okay.
first watch for James Cameron. I listed James Cameron as my favorite director, and people are like, "What do you don't mean Spielberg or you know,
right.
you know Lucas?" But I'm like, no, I personally really like what he's done for the industry. I mean, he's pushed it technologically just as much as Lucas has. I mean, it's incredible.
No, absolutely.
And I like Aliens also because it's a sequel, but it's also a different genre. So not only does he take the you know, I have Darren's rule of sequels where the second movie, if you're going to make a sequel, it needs to answer a question from the first and improve upon it. And that's what
yeah.
Aliens does. It answers the question, who lays the eggs?
Yeah.
At its core, that's what it's about. And it shifts it from a horror genre to an action genre. And it does
right.
it very well. I mean, I think Aliens is an amazing movie.
It is. And it's arguably the best of that series, easily one of the best science fiction action movies of all time. And it is insane. I mean, that was Ridley Scott made a very singular artistic effort that I would never kudos to Cameron for making something that not only was its equal, but expanded on so many of the ideas. You have so much more about Ripley's character and all that stuff. But like, I've always admired James Cameron a lot. And I'm consistently impressed by him, even as he delves more into the technical side of things. I know
right.
We were kind of we got to
be patient with Cameron, like really patient.
Right. And I think more than just being like an awesome like innovator for film, I know he comes across as kind of a jerk, and a lot of times you'll hear horror stories about him on set of how, like he's a dictator and he wants things his way, he's a perfectionist,
yeah.
and that really, like, ruins people's lives. But I've also heard stories completely to the contrary about how loyal and amazing he is as a friend. And one story I love to bring up in regards to James Cameron that I think really sells him as like a pretty awesome guy is Guillermo del Toro, one of my favorite filmmakers. He his father was kidnapped by the cartel, I believe, Mexico.
That's right.
And was held for ransom. And the ransom was $1 million. And Guillermo del Toro was like, I don't have $1 million. He and James Cameron, to this day, are extremely close friends. They were at the time as well. Cameron kind of took him under his wing. I think this is early 2000. So Cameron had definitely taken him under his wing at that point.
So post and, Titanic, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Del Toro just mentioned this. Like, he's like, this thing is, you know, my father. I don't know what I'm going to do. And Cameron paid the ransom, $1 million. He paid it, no questions asked. He was like, I'll take care of this. And I know also the whole thing with I think there was something with I'd hate to bring Harvey Weinstein into this because screw that guy, but I know Cameron confronted Weinstein about the way he treated Del Toro with Mimic, because Mimic was such a disaster and Del Toro had so much trouble with the studio. And Cameron almost came to blows with Weinstein about it, where he's basically like, you're an idiot. Let this guy make the movie
he wants
to make.
He's a very strong personality.
That's
for sure.
So it's like, regardless of the however like anal he might be, however overbearing and however much of a bully he might be on set, there are stories like that where I'm like, this guy's kind of awesome. And I've always fallen on that side as far as how I feel about him. And I'm excited to watch this because, again, this is, like I said, it feels like it's the forgotten James Cameron movie that no one really talks about, at least from when his career started to take off. No one really talks about The Abyss that much.
No, and I would say only James Cameron could make this film. I mean, it was a hard production. I mean, just like how Steven Spielberg was like, oh, I'm going to shoot actually on the ocean, which everyone tells you don't shoot on the ocean. James Cameron's like, I'm going to actually shoot in water. And people are like, don't actually shoot in water. And he pushed the technology so hard to, like, his son helped develop basically an underwater sky crane. And it was basically a, like, water jets that connected to a camera so you could get basically a jib shot underwater. I mean, they invented that. They invented the dive helmets that you see in the movie because that way you can see the actor's face and you can also record the dialogue and use that in the actually recorded a little bit of ADR, but most of it's right from the helmet microphones.
That's so cool.
And also remember, I mean, you have your CGI tentacle, you know, water tentacle face, which was actually the first shot. This isn't spoil things, but it was the first shot. So they had enough. They sent it immediately to the special effects house to say, make this because give you the most time. But remember that that's it for CGI in the entire movie. And it's right in that, you know, it's 89. You haven't had Terminator 2 yet. You haven't had Jurassic Park yet. So everything is in the water or miniatures. And I don't feel like that's going to ruin. I mean, obviously that's kind of knowledge. That's not going to ruin it. But when you're watching it, snap back at least once or twice and just think about the fact of what you're seeing was created with miniatures, and it's amazing. Like the scale that he took things at. They filmed in the largest underwater tank in the world. It was 7 million gallons, and they basically used a decommissioned, not completed nuclear reactor bowl and just filled it with water. Like it's it's incredible.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I mean, I honestly, my expectations are high, not just because you're hyping it up, but because I've been very excited to watch this. It's nice to, especially with a great filmmaker, to watch a movie in their filmography that doesn't have a whole lot of, it's not like you're watching The Dark Knight, or it's not even like you're watching Terminator 2 for the first time. It's like there aren't any, no one is talking about this movie as far as like, this is the movie you need to see. So I like going into a movie with a filmmaker like Cameron attached that doesn't have a whole lot of weight to me. Like it doesn't feel like I'm like, I don't feel like anyone is pressuring me to love this movie. Anyone is pressuring me. I mean, you're pressuring me. You have a gun to my head, which I understand. You love this movie, but really you don't have to point that at me. But no, honestly, it's cool to watch this because I am I've been meaning to for a long time, and it's fun to just kind of, it feels like this kind of snuck up under the radar, and I'm excited I get to watch it.
And that's
it.
The whole point of Missing Frames is these
exactly.
movies that sneak up under your radar that you're like, oh, why haven't I seen that? And
yep.
And last thing I'll say about The Abyss is the cast is really good too. It's the main three are Ed Harris, Michael Biehn, and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
It's okay. She understands.
She was
she knows
made
her name is hard to pronounce.
In Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
yeah.
then obviously Michael Biehn has been in like a million James Cameron movies, so that's, you know, not.
So there, yeah. That's
and then
awesome.
Ed Harris from, you know, like The Rock and
yes, everything,
Apollo
pretty
13.
Much everything, almost yeah. everything you've ever seen in your life.
Exactly. So it's great. It's I won't give too much. I don't think I'm gonna say anything more about the plot, just to let you soak it in. But it's from the technical aspect, it's I'd say it's right up there. I'm not gonna say it's the Avatar of its day, because Avatar is like, but as far as what it pushed, as far as filmmaking techniques, which is why I highly recommend watching the behind the scenes after, you know, once you've decompressed. But it's a really good story with really good characters, and just the fact that it was made is incredible to me, because it was definitely a hard film to make, just in general.
Right. Right. Well, that's awesome. Let's go ahead and let's make it happen. Let's watch The Abyss.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. The Abyss has been seen. We've gone down to the deepest depths of the Abyss. And Darren, I am happy to say I did enjoy this movie. I have issues with it, but overall I enjoyed it. It was fascinating to watch, and I'm so glad I got a chance to watch that documentary as well, because it is an astonishing technical achievement at the very least. Yeah, at the very least, you have to just sit back and acknowledge that. And it's a near 3 hour long movie, but it didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't feel the length. It wasn't really. It wasn't really a problem for me. I was never bored. It did feel like a few different movies kind of put into one. That I got that kind of vibe from it. I don't. Is that a feel that you get from it? Does it seem to feel like a few different ideas put together for you, or how does that
again, it's interesting if you look at where it is in relation to his other works. Like we mentioned before, you know, this is right after Aliens but before Terminator, and it's very, you know, blue collar, like we're just oil workers, but we just happen to be doing it at the bottom of the ocean, you know.
Yeah.
it's like well, no big deal, we'll just uncouple the wellhead. It's like, yeah, but you're at the bottom of the ocean, like
exactly. I it's funny that, because, you know, he had directed Aliens, and Aliens feels so different from Alien,
right.
Ridley Scott's movie.
Yes.
But what's funny about The Abyss is The Abyss feels like Alien to me. Like you have a bunch of,
yeah.
you have this kind of, you know, like we said, blue collar workers in a very claustrophobic setting, dealing with forces that they don't understand.
Right.
Very like it's more,
yes.
It's more of a thriller than kind of an action movie like Aliens is. So I got a very strong Alien vibe from it. In fact, this feels not that Aliens doesn't feel like a sequel to Alien, but this almost felt a little bit more like a spiritual sequel to Alien.
Yes,
than
I was just
than Aliens
say
did.
Spiritual sequel. Yeah, exactly, because the Nostromo crew, they're just haulers. You know, they're working for the company, they get their paycheck, and they just happen to be in space, you know.
Yeah.
And then you have the crew of the Benthic Explorer, Deep Core, and they're just oil workers who just are trying out this new rig, and it just happens to be, you know, at the bottom of the ocean. So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think spiritual successor to Alien as far as that tone, I think you're dead on. But I wouldn't say it goes horror. It's still fantastical. It's like the things that are happening to them, and just also like the Nostromo crew, it's all about these normal people. I mean, still at the bottom of the ocean, but they're pushed out of their routine and comfort zone into dealing with a submarine that's down and Marines on board and, you know, NTIs floating around outside. So some really not normal stuff is going at them and how they react. You know, I love the characters in this movie. I love their little idiosyncrasies and their little nicknames like One Night and Hippie and Bud. And it feels like they've been doing this for years together.
Well, Cameron does this. All his movies feel this way, and or most of his best movies do that well, which is having a strong ensemble with characters that feel unique. And he really, like, they, like you said, they all have their little idiosyncrasies. They all have, like, you know, there's the black woman with the cowboy hat. There's Ed Harris, the noble guy, the guy with the rat. There's the guy with the beard. But they all have very strong personalities. And Cameron's very good at that. He's also very good to a certain extent at dialogue. I thought some of the dialogue was a little goofy. Like, you know, it was I was trying to get into the flow of what these characters, kind of their relationships were. It took me a little bit because it felt a little Cameron always walks a fine line between, like, really absurd characterizations and dialogue and, like, fun, like, engaging dialogue that it but it always feels very much like a movie, like movie dialogue. Like, he's writing it and he knows exactly, like, yes, I'm going to write this line because it's a funny line. Like, keep your pantyhose on and things like that.
Yeah,
and
pantyhose on is probably the least, it didn't age the best of all his lines.
Right.
But I will say that upon watching this again, because it had been a little while since I last watched it, it definitely just ages and matures with the more you watch it. The more you watch it, the more you'll just, because now you're not being exposed to these characters. You're just you're really going into their interpersonal connections and their little nods to each other, and the fact that, again, they're going through this incredible situation and just coping with it.
Right. Yeah.
And I really enjoyed my most recent viewing for sure.
That's awesome. And it was definitely one of those things where it takes some time to get going, as far as, like, you know, you start off with the submarine attack. They run into, what is it? Is it
NTI. I mean, the whole opening, basically it's the prologue, is the Montana going down, which is, like, not really what you expect, because it you never really see these people again, but do you want to go through some, like, story beats?
Let's do it. So it starts, it's an effective way to open the movie. You're kind of like, what's going on? What's the mystery of this? It sets it up. It kind of sets it up as, like, oh, it's a disaster movie, and you introduce the crew. I'm going to butcher everyone's names.
That's all right. I got IMDb up because it helps a lot. But it opens up with the Montana, and it's great storytelling. It's right in the middle of the action. Like, they're it's not the Montana pulling away from its birth. It's like, no, it's like in the middle of this canyon underwater. It gets caught. Everyone on board is, like, freaking out because this unidentified thing is going 120 knots, which I don't really know what that means because I'm not a submarine captain. But
you don't know what that means? Everybody knows what that means, Darren. Are you crazy?
But from the reaction, that's not normal. So that's enough for me. And then they crash. And now we got to rescue them.
It's funny because, you know, it's almost a very Star Trek plot in a way. It's like you're the only crew in range to rescue this and excavate this missile or the
Enterprise
warhead.
Is the only ship in the quadrant or
exactly.
Whatever they
it felt very Star Trek to me. Like, I was like, huh, this seems very familiar. But of course, you know, Bud, who is played by Ed Harris, his crew is they happen to be the only ones in range who can get to the ship or the submarine to recover the information that that the Army needs to just
I think they're trying to either, if there's any survivors, you know, or also just secure the location because it's one of their subs went down mysteriously. Like, that's not good.
Right, exactly. So, and there's a hurricane coming and
exactly.
So all kinds of crazy stuff is going on. So you know, of course there's a time crunch to it, and they're the only ones who can make it. So you spend some time time getting to know the crew a little bit. You establish the relationship between Bud and his ex-wife.
And Lindsay.
Lindsay, that's right. Yep.
So they're divorced, but it's not final. Like, he hasn't signed the paperwork or something.
Very, very classic kind of storyline where it's like, oh, you still have your wedding ring and da-da-da.
Right, which comes into be a key plot point later on.
Yeah, and that was great. I just, like, I loved... James Cameron, he does just such a great job of like I said, he has very striking personalities for characters. He's very good at that, and he's just a great storyteller. And that was just a wonderful moment. That payoff with the ring was so good when it saves his life and keeps
the
door
open. It saves
his
life, yeah.
Exactly. And I loved that so much.
So one of the things, if you had watched the theatrical version, what James Cameron... did, and I think they mentioned this some in the behind the scenes documentary, is he cut out a lot of subplot. So a lot of the interpersonal parts of their, you know, failing marriage and a lot of the NTIs was cut from the theatrical. So you don't actually see him throw away the ring and put it back on. You don't see that in the theatrical, but I love that scene being in there because you're seeing him make that choice to keep it on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was going to ask you, because I, you know, obviously, you know, we watched the special edition. This is the only version I've seen at this point. So I was going to ask you, what were the differences? Because the documentary does kind of hint. So the ending with the tsunami, like the giant tidal waves,
you
that
don't
wasn't
see the
in the
way,
theatrical?
You don't see the, you see a little bit of them. Basically, he's like, you guys are doing this. What's going on? And then he's like, but yeah, the whole tsunami wave, the all the stuff with the reporter who's like, we're going to stay and film this. A lot of the third act was just cut. And that's why, I said, you got to watch this version. Now, again, he still goes down there. He still stops the Merv, and he still encounters the aliens. But all the whole, basically the meat message of like, hey, we're not the only ones on this planet and you better watch out. That's all gone. And then through the rest of the story is a lot of these just little interpersonal moments that just, especially between Bud and Lindsay, just kind of get trimmed away.
I figured a lot of the character moments were what had been cut out, but that to me seems super significant.
Yeah.
The ending, because if you get rid of the tsunami, it almost...
It kind of negates what the NTIs are all about.
Well, that it negates that. They're just like a mysterious, they live at the bottom of the ocean.
And it's already taking a left turn at the third act. You really need that payoff what did I just watch?
Yeah, and there's no, I mean, that is what creates the tension. I mean, you want Bud to live, obviously, but having that final moment, it's like there's a reason behind it.
Exactly.
But also, that being said, there is this movie goes to a lot of places, and I, as much as I admire the movie, it felt like it, like I said, it was a lot of stuff crammed into this movie. Like, James Cameron had a couple ideas, but he wasn't quite sure which one he wanted to follow, because you have the very claustrophobic, like, they're very, like, you know, it's underwater, all this stuff going on, all these ships, all these mechanisms.
You have the military aspect.
Right, the military
with,
you know, something that Cameron does a lot is, the military is evil and the scientists
are good.
Working with
Michael Biehn again, because he was in Aliens. And
Michael Biehn, who is a bad guy for once.
He's a scary bad guy.
He is.
Like,
he's really good. Yeah. It was fun to watch him play this kind of role, because, you know, I really haven't seen him in much outside of James Cameron's film. So to see him play kind of against type, at least for James Cameron, was a lot of fun. But that even feels like a separate movie. Like,
could be its own movie.
Exactly. Yeah. That felt very much like, you know, in the middle of the movie, they have this confrontation with him, and that felt like its own thing. And then it was kind of like, and now there's the aliens. There's an alien in this movie. So it was very, there are a lot of things that, it felt like the movie lacked focus in some ways, because it was trying to do a lot
of
stuff.
The runtime, I think the fact that it told three stories in 3 hours is basically what it did. And I think the problem is you couldn't really split it up into three chunks and cut one chunk out. I mean, they basically, that's what they did, is they trimmed the most from the third story, which was the NTI story, but the other changes you would have had to make, like, on the drafting board in the script phase to really to par it down. So yeah, it's a bit of a wild ride and a lot is going on, but it is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's true. And I took me probably until the point, I think the moment where the movie really grabbed me and finally started to, I was like, okay, I'm into this, was the moment when the crane gets destroyed and it's dragging them down.
And that's really the beginning of the second act, if you think about it. That's the twist. I mean, everything's been twisting up to then, but that's where it's like, oh, we're cut off from our support ship, we're damaged, we're leaking, and things just went sideways.
Exactly. Yeah.
And
so
that's
that
such
was
a great sequence.
It's extremely exciting, and as clunky as I felt some of the dialogue, I know there was one line I wrote down was, "I want everyone finished, prepped, and ready to get wet in 15 minutes." I was like, "Oh my god, that's classic Cameron, just goofy, like kind
you
of."
You can see
like
him saying that to his crew as he's actually filming it. Yeah, and he's like, "Oh, that's good. You say that now, bud."
Like, let's put exactly. So it was, there was the almost, I was like, did Almost Famous steal the scene where they're all singing together to that country song?
I love that scene. That's so,
I was like, I think Cameron Crowe may have robbed this moment. But you don't really feel the tension until that moment where it's like everything is exploding, everything's going wrong, people are dying, and it's like, whoa.
Right.
And you just remember how good Cameron is at crafting suspenseful action sequences. And that had me on the edge of my seat. I loved it. And again, and I talked about this, I did an episode when Dunkirk came out on Filibuster with Matt Hansen, another Nerd Party member. And I talked about how one of my like biggest fears is drowning. So any movie that features like a significant amount of like water or underwater stuff is always like it adds that extra layer of tension for me, because I'm always very, I love like anything underwater in the ocean is fascinating, unless it's the movie Thunderball. I think it's really fascinating, because otherwise Thunderball is pretty boring when it comes to underwater.
I mean, Thunderball
is
basically like it was shot in a pool compared to this, which feels like it was shot in the, like that's the comparison. Yeah,
exactly. I love that stuff, but having that extra layer of tension because it's a personal fear of mine just gives the scenes such a kick to watch and like to
be really on edge.
And I loved it, but it was really cool. And then of the movie, like I said, the movie really works for me with the action scenes,
it does take a long burn of like establishing the characters, which you probably didn't need quite that much. But once it goes into that second act and the crane falls, it's pretty much nonstop at that point.
Right. And again, when that action stops and we kind of start to introduce like, okay, there's tension between Michael Biehn and his mustache and the rest of everybody.
he does have a pretty good mustache.
It's a spectacular mustache. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. I was jealous the whole time. I couldn't get over it, but, you stop again, and then you bring the alien back into it. So like I said, there are a lot of things competing, a lot of plots, a lot of themes competing. Yeah. And the whole time I'm watching it, I'm fascinated by it, but I felt it. And I was like, yeah, I see James Cameron's fascination. He wanted to include the alien element and that like beautiful moment with the CGI water. The only moment I knew was in this movie. I didn't realize it took place so early. I thought that was going to be more of a climactic moment. Like, this is when they finally meet it.
And it's
so,
like, probably in the middle, middle third, like it's,
right in the middle. And it's a really cool moment, and I loved all the scenes where they're kind of like interacting with the aliens and meeting them and kind of seeing them for the first time. They really contain that kind of sense of wonder
to do an action movie that also has a sense of wonder. Like, that's kind of like mixing oil and water. Like, what's it gonna give you?
Exactly. Because you don't want to, an audience expecting an action movie is not going to want to sit there and see these like, oh, very slow, thoughtful moments where these beautiful, they want a certain thing. And then on the flip side, you don't want to alienate the audience that is there for the wonder and doesn't really want too much of the suspense. So I can understand why audiences didn't really respond to this when it first came out, partially because now that you're telling me what the special edition added that was not in the theatrical version, it was probably even more kind of baffling to people trying to figure out, like, okay, what's going on here? It definitely feels more organic with the special edition and what they had in there. But
because you're in it by the time you get to that last act, but you need some sort of payoff. Or it's very much a shrug of like, okay, that happened. And
yeah, so it was around that point in the movie, it was kind of like it becomes, you know, the scientists versus the military, which, again, like I said, is very Cameron plotline. It felt, you know, oh, I see. Yeah. Avatar totally is that, but without kind of the depth, both the literal depth of being way underwater in the ocean and the depth of the characters in the storyline.
And you also have to remember, you know, this is 89. This is height of like Cold War. And so, I mean, you have this huge nuclear angle of, you know, I mean, they bring a warhead on board the ship and like hippies like freaking out, which is hilarious because. And what's funny is that like he's actually the only one that doesn't see the water tentacle, the pseudopod. He's like not in. He's like not in that part of the deep core, but yeah, it's now I'm wondering when you were watching it, did it ever trigger in your mind remembering, oh my gosh, this is 89. Like all of this stuff is practical.
Well,
like,
that's that one, something that I, that never ceases to amaze me with Cameron. And I think I talked a little bit about this in the first part of our episode is no one does scale like him. No one does epic like him, and you forget that with a movie like Avatar because it's essentially a cartoon. I mean, it's all animated.
I mean, so much of it is everything on the screen is CG.
Exactly. So you forget how skilled he is at making these expansive, believable worlds. I mean, this was the largest freshwater tank.
It was 7 million galleons shot in the bottom of a unfinished nuclear reactor site.
Like, I mean, the whole time
just
I'm
that sentence doesn't make sense.
The whole time I'm watching, I'm thinking like, how did they do this? And when I watched the documentary and realized, oh, they shot under. Yeah. Oh my god! Like this is. Oh my god! Like it was just amazing. Like I was like, holy crap! I can't believe this. And the amount of like, you know, you were telling me this is hell for everyone involved. That does not surprise me in the least. But you look at the production design, you look at the sets, you look at the designs of the ships and the little like mini submarines that they operate, and like,
they're actually subs. I mean, that's And I'm glad you had the opportunity to watch the documentary. It's one of, like I've said before, my favorite documentaries, and it gives you just this whole extra appreciation for what they did because. I mean, I think what it really boils down to is these aren't necessarily actors wearing costumes. These are divers wearing life support systems and acting. Yeah. Like that's, you know, like if they don't do it right, like there's a danger there. And you have dozens of people in this pool because it's not just the people we see on screen. We see, it's their safety divers. It's the technicians. It's the cameramen. It's the lighting. All of this stuff is in the pool. And trying to communicate underwater. I mean, it's just, it's nuts.
Like, it's
hard
enough.
It could only be made in 89 by Cameron. I don't think anyone else at any other time could or would make this movie.
No, and it's hard enough to coordinate stunts and sets and people and effects and all this stuff when you're on ground, when you're on dry land. To do it underwater, it's just like the amount of pressure on him and the, like they were talking, Cameron would spend 12-hour days underwater just shooting this stuff, and that's insane to me. Like another thing that gets to me is claustrophobia. So it's like the combination of being underwater and feeling on those claustrophobic.
And you're
sets,
in that helmet.
I don't think I have to give so many props to everyone involved with this movie. I don't think I could ever. Do this. I mean, it's like I can't imagine how much how insane it was to shoot this movie. And on top of that, you know, we talked a little bit about the production woes. Ed Harris doesn't want to talk about this movie ever again.
Yeah, like pretty much if what he said in the documentary is it, you're not going to get him to talk about it ever again, which I totally understand because it sounded like it was really, really
well
hard.
So they had him strapped up, and they have the scene where he's real like going
in the dive suit
to disable the bomb, and he also has the added layer of water in his helmet. So it's
right.
Like
he's not actually, which that is the only part where I'm like, you couldn't have designed a second helmet that actually was a helmet. But it's like, no, he's right. Literally holding his breath for all those shots behind a pink faceplate. I'm like, wow, that's
that's terrifying. And also terrifying was the fact when they had the scene with the rat to explain what that liquid was.
And that's all true. I mean, that's legitimately a technology.
Well, I was watching it and I was like, oh my God, that rat. Is that a mechanical rat? No, that looks real. And this is horrifying. They're drowning that rat. And then I read that like, oh no, they've done testing with this liquid and it works
on
animals.
It's obviously not. Humans don't use it, but rats, we haven't gotten to humans yet. Yeah,
man, I think it was in the UK or somewhere they cut that whole scene out.
Yeah, the UK, the royal veterinarian said, nope, that hurts the rat. Don't put that in. And they cut it out.
Can't blame them because watching that, like, I'm an animal lover. That moment hurt me to watch. I was like, oh, God, this is awful. But then, you know, the rat's totally fine and everything. Right. But it still was like watching it like underwater. Yeah, I was just trying to figure out how they did it. And then I found out they actually did it, which is just insane. But it speaks it speaks to the power of just the practicality of everything, and seeing it is just it's so much more effective than if it had been made today. It would have been, you know, tons of CGI.
It would have been covered in CGI, which again, that's how you would do it. I'm not saying that's bad. It's just and speaking of drowning, I mean, there's the culmination scene of, you know, of Lindsay drowning in the sub. And gosh, that's anyone who has like a significant other, that's hard to watch.
For me, that was easily the best sequence in the film. Mm-hmm. I was like on the edge of my seat. It was so powerful, that moment when like she's like, this is what we're gonna do, I'm gonna drown, you're gonna save me.
that's the plan, and you're gonna bring me back.
It was like, oh my God. But then they like the performance is like, I liked Ed Harris in the movie. I thought she was like a little stilted at the beginning, but like, man, that scene, she is so good, and she is so effective at like, I she's terrified. And I felt so terrified for her. But like that moment, it's like the whole movie, I've been kind of like, okay, it's a little clunky. There's a lot of good action. It's very like a lot of we've got to take down the military guy. And it's very like big moments, very like intense
and
moments.
And leading up to the drowning scene, you have the entire sub fight.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
Already that was amazing,
so
with coffee zipping around. And
you have a big action sequence that leads into this. So that caught me almost completely off guard because it's a very emotional human moment. And then, you know, he brings her back and you're like on the edge of your seat. It's so suspenseful. You're like, oh, my God, is she going to live? And they have the whole CPR scene where it's like, oh, she's dead. And is she going to make it? And Ed Harris, man, what a performance. And then you find out, you know, in the documentary that she was so pissed off. Because what happened was they were shooting the scene and she's, you know, in the moment, and it's hours and hours of her laying there and pretending to be dead. It's just like, you know, it's taking its toll on everybody. And then the camera ran out of film and she just like had it, and she like storms off set.
And so, you totally don't blame her.
No, not at all. And Ed Harris had to sell the scene. She wasn't even there, and he basically had to do it without her. And my God, that whole sequence was like, it blew me away. It totally had the emotional impact.
And then you have
it
the decompress where like they're all crying and they're hugging each other, and you feel, you're like, dang, that was that was.
I mean,
and then you start the third act, and that's when you start to go towards the liquid breathing and the. But yeah, it's, dear Lord, you're just like, you need to come up for air.
Literally get out of there, come up for air, get on land. I'm tired of being underwater. That was by far, I think, the strongest sequence of the movie. That was my favorite scene. What would you say is yours?
Gosh, that's I just love the whole. I love the whole thing. No, it's I think. I think like shot wise, I really love, you know, like we were talking about the whole scene where they're towing the deep core, and they're just singing, and it's just like another day on the job. Got to move the bass, you know, to the next spot. But I love pretty much all the miniature work. I mean, the miniature work on this movie is amazing. From the Montana sub, which is a 30-foot miniature. I mean, it's huge. Yeah. To how they did the scene where they discover the Montana, and they have the three subs going over it, and that was shot. And this is what, you know, really spiked my interest in filmmaking was this specifically, was they shot it what's called dry for wet. So basically they shot in a smoke-filled soundstage and had this amazing gimbal moving all these subs around the Montana. And they even had little tiny projectors that were advancing a single picture frame per still shot. And it's totally convincing. Like, I mean, there's a little bit when they're like getting really close to the mini subs that you're kind of like, okay, that's a little bit of lensing there. But overall, that shot still holds up almost like 30 years later.
There's so much of this movie that I know it. People who listen to this podcast know I sound like a film snob frequently, and I'm going to sound like a film snob even more, but I feel like movies like this prove why practical effects are always just so much more effective. And that's not to say CGI isn't effective, and I think a combination of the two can be extremely effective, like you see in like Lord of the Rings and
Lord of the Rings. I mean, I hadn't really seen anything on this scale again until Lord of the Rings, really.
Yeah,
which
I mean,
took it to a whole other level. But
and I just like it, you, I love, you know, Cameron is just a master of really selling you on these epic worlds. You believe in it, and you believe in the science because he does his research and he fills in the technical jargon, even if it's complete nonsense. You believe it, and he puts in the work to do that. And he might be a nightmare to work with, and it might be a nightmare to film a movie like this, but like, he gets the job done. And things like that, like there's so much in this movie that I just fully believed in it. And, you know, even seeing like with Ed Harris, when he has to swim all the way to the pool where he like just goes underwater and has to swim from
When the part of the ship is cut off from another part and he's got to get to the moon pool. And so he's free swimming from hatch to hatch, and you know, you're like, and again, then you remember, oh, this actually has to be shot in camera. I mean, if there's not a cut, there's not a cut. He's literally doing that.
He's doing it, and like, you know, he talks about how it's like you get to where you're supposed to go, you hit your mark, and then you have to wait for the people who have to be far away because they have to be out of the shot to come swimming in to get you your air. I just can't imagine.
No. And you try that, holding your breath like while the scene is going, and you're just like, no,
you're like,
there's no way.
You have to like figure in the fact that you're moving, you're swimming,
you're exerting
energy.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I mean, this movie, no doubt, and as clearly demonstrated by the documentary, was a pain to shoot. do you feel it pays off? I mean, is it something where like
totally?
Yeah, it's just a question of, and I think it does too, but it's also a question of, you look at the film's reputation, and practically everyone involved, it feels like, has just kind of not sworn
the
movie off.
We don't
want to
talk about it.
No one wants to talk about it. James Cameron doesn't want to talk about it, although I will say it's kind of funny that apparently Avatar 2, he's doing underwater again, and he's developing new technology for that. I thought, you know, he talks about how he's never want to do this again.
The fact that The Abyss doesn't have a Blu-ray. I mean, that's
crazy.
That's
exactly right. That's and how in this day and age, when you have someone like James Cameron, who's all about pushing technology forward and doing innovative new special effects, the fact that this movie's not on Blu-ray, that it's like one of the only movies of his that's not on Blu-ray, is insane. I wonder, like, it's like, what do you think, you know, beyond the level of entertainment, beyond the level of us watching it and being able to be impressed by it, do you think it was worth it? Like, do you think, like, the actors feel like it was worth it? I don't know.
Nobody died, so I guess that's, I mean, in that regard.
That's
like,
definitely an accomplishment.
Really potential, but, well, hopefully we'll get a Blu-ray next year, because next year, being, you know, 2019, will be 30 years since the movie. But, yeah, it's, I mean, I like a lot of what Ed Harris says in the documentary of basically, this movie was hell, but he's like, I'm really proud of a lot of the things we did, a lot of the physicality, a lot of the moving, you know, learning, you know, actually diving and just you hitting those walls internally of what you think you can do and pushing past them. And, you know, and a lot of that driving force is Cameron shoving you along the way. But,
yeah,
you know, you can tell that that he is very proud of what he did. He doesn't ever wants to do it again, which I don't blame him, but
no, definitely. And then, so, you know, past all that, you know, we get to the third act, which was right. super divisive when it was released theatrically, because people, it felt even more unjustified without the kind of the buildup. And then right. without the real true motivation for the scene, which was that the aliens were about to destroy the world. Now I will say this. I thought, it still feels like a left turn for me for them to be like, and it by is. The way, we're going to destroy everything. It was like, wait, where did that come from? And it felt a little too, I don't want to say ham-fisted, but it was a little ham-fisted for them to kind of pull the whole.
It's
like,
very message.
Yes. That like, you know, yeah. I got Avatar vibes from it, which is like, oh, nature is beautiful and mankind is destroying it. So I got kind of a little, I was like, all right, James Cameron. Because at the end, and Ed Harris is like, when they finally get out of the water, Ed Harris is like, yeah, we had a good talk and we're going to change some things around
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
It was a
There's
little.
A little bit. Of explanation kind of at the very end where they're like, oh, we should be dead. We didn't decompress. I guess they did something.
Right.
It's like, okay.
It's like they spend more time
That's a
saying.
Line.
Yeah. yeah. They spend more time saying like, and what lesson did we learn today, yeah. everybody? Than they do. They threw that in as kind of a talk. Like it was like James Cameron like had filmed the movie and then realized, oh crap, we didn't explain how they didn't get decompression sickness when they came out of the water. And so he threw that like really quick, like, hey, what happened? Right. I don't know, but that felt right. a little goofy to me. And it kind of, again, it emphasized, like, what is this
it
movie about?
It 100% stick the landing.
Yeah.
It doesn't discount being a great film overall.
Sure.
But it just didn't have, it's not like Rogue One where the third act was the best part.
Right, right, exactly. It was.
The
it
second
was,
act is probably the best part.
I think so, too. The whole movie is fascinating, with the second act being the strongest part, and everything. It just felt like Cameron really wanted to do something super ambitious, and
yeah.
not just like with the underwater, but it felt like he just had so many ideas, and he was just like, well, why not just do all, let's go all out. And some of them I'm like, I, you know, if you had just made it a little bit tighter, kind of honed in on what you really wanted to say and focus in on that, I think it could have been that much stronger.
You know, I think you're right, because it does have a tiny bit of a, and kind of all of Cameron's has this, but it has a little bit of what I call, you know, Peter Jackson's King Kong syndrome, where it's like,
yeah.
who's going to tell the man who made Lord of the Rings, no, this is a really long movie with way too much in it that you need to cut down. Like, who's going to tell James Cameron, the man who, I'm assuming Aliens made money hands over
yeah,
fist, because that's
yeah.
the only way. You know, you're going to get this greenlit. But yeah, it's, and Cameron's a super strong personality. So again, that pushback, that counter that we know from Lucas to Spielberg, like all good directors need that counter to produce their best stuff.
Yes.
And he didn't quite have enough of that to just click this down a little bit on the runtime and a little bit on the scope, you know, into something that would have a Blu-ray by now. But
yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, you've got to admire the ambition, but then it's like, it's crazy that like just a few years later he makes a movie that is pretty much just as expansive, just as long, well, not 3 hours long, but it's like 2.5 hours long or close to it. But like Terminator 2 comes out and it's like a revolutionary action film.
Right.
It's interesting just to like, you know, you could watch Aliens and Terminator 2 and kind of be like, all right, cool, I see how you get from Aliens to Terminator 2. But The Abyss is like, it feels like a necessary part of his filmography. It feels like,
yeah.
even though people don't talk about it as much, and even if it isn't as strong of a film, it still feels like he really, like, it was like a trial by fire. I mean, trial by water.
Trial
really,
by
but,
water.
But, it's almost a necessary bridge for him.
Yeah.
To get,
I don't think
from
he could
aliens.
Have gone from Aliens to Terminator 2, technology wise as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think from what we know of CGI, I mean, again, this is pre Jurassic Park. This is, you know, the pseudopod, like, I mean, that's the reason you know of it, is because in film history, that shot is like, was one of the first uses of like liquid water CGI, like that had never been done before. And that let him do, I mean, think about if Terminator 2 didn't have the T-1000 being liquid metal, like basically without the technology he developed for the Abyss, you would not have that for T2.
Exactly. So what do you think it is? Why do you think that the Abyss is just not part of the conversation as much? Why don't people talk about this movie as much?
I mean, it could just be, you know, it's late 80s. It's it naturally, Cameron has so many shining stars in his filmography. It's like something is going to settle to the bottom. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the worst. It's just, it's not Aliens. It's not Terminator. It's not Terminator 2. It's not Titanic. It's not Avatar. Yeah. And already now you're six down. So it's kind of just by chance. But one other point I wanted to make with, like, you've mentioned his ability for world building and just placing you in this world. There's two little Easter eggs that come out of this, which I love, is in Terminator 2, again, his next movie, the gas station that they hide out in is a benthic petroleum gas station, which I love.
That's great.
Because it's like, I got my own gas company, so why not use it for my film? And then in the movie Twister, the where they're running from the Twister in the truck, and the fuel truck like lifts up and crashes down, it's got benthic petroleum on its side. So,
oh, interesting. So wait, what was Cameron's involvement with Twister?
You know, I'm not sure.
Was it just I wonder if he had something
to do with
the effects.
It might have just been an homage. Like, yeah. You know, I don't, I mean, you got Bill Paxton, which, you know, had worked with him before. I don't think there's any like on paper connection. I think it might literally just be, unless it's like the same production company, which
Only thing I can think is that, you know, because Cameron is such a proponent for pushing the envelope with effects and technology, Twister is, you know, it's a crazy effects movie. And I wonder if he kind of stepped in to kind of offer his expertise, and maybe it was an homage to him as a result, kind of like a thank you to him.
Or it could be the effects house that's making it also did the effects, and they're just like, oh, well, why don't we just make this a, you know, I'm sure they get the okay nod, and then they're just like, it's this fun little, it's literally an Easter egg. It's just, it doesn't affect the plot at all, but it's a fun thing.
That
and
is
I
awesome.
Love that. So I think I love having that. I love that little thread that it's in those other movies, as well as just the whole benthic explorer, that ship, the double hold crane toting, you know, support ship, which was the only model that actually sailed on the sea. I think it was like 35 feet long or something. It had to be registered by the Coast Guard. It was so big. it's insane. It's just crazy.
Cameron's just nuts. That's really all there is to it. Do you want him to kind of come back and like not necessarily make a sequel, but is there a part of you just watching these movies? I miss the old James Cameron. I miss when
the 80s, 90s James
Cameron. I just miss like, you know, I feel like he lost something in the 90s. Like, you know, Titanic, I know it has its supporters. I don't think I admire it more than I enjoy it. I think it's too long. I think its story and characters are a little cheesy. Same thing with Avatar. I admire it. I loved it when I saw it in theaters and was blown away by the technology. But you watch it at home and it's like, there's something about like old school Cameron that is on full display in The Abyss. Even if he is giving in to his worst tendencies as a storyteller at times, I sometimes just want him to go back and kind of just do something like this. Like, I feel like sometimes he gets so caught up in the technology, which was, you know, something that,
which was his thing.
Yeah, that's his thing. I mean, you can't really knock him for that. And in this day and age, it's all about computer technology. So I guess it's just natural. But there's a part of me that wishes he'd go back to something like just like with these beautiful sets and things like that. I mean, do you ever kind of wish maybe
it feels
he'd
like exponentially his movie releases are like spreading out? Yeah. I mean, you had that, you know, the 80s, 90s where it's like Terminator, Aliens, Abyss, Terminator 2, True Lies, like boom, 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 boom. Then you have a tiny gap and while he's doing Titanic because it's Titanic, like
yeah.
the ability. And then, so Titanic's 97, his next film is Avatar in 09. That's like over 10
right.
years later. I
right.
mean, he does other things in between and goes to like the bottom of the ocean. So he's busy. He's a busy man. But now, you know, we're almost 10 years after that, and it's going to be Avatar 2, and supposedly a little more rapid succession after that. But it's like, it's just, and maybe that's just, maybe it's like inverse Murphy's law of like technology. Like, it was easier to push the technology from what it was in the 80s and 90s, but now it's already gotten so far.
It's hard.
If you're really
yeah.
gonna, if you're going to double it as far as its ability, it's going to take 10 years.
I almost feel like he's more interested in pushing the technology envelope than he is in telling good, involving stories.
Yeah.
I feel like if
Lucas likes pushing the envelope, but not like Cameron. Like Cameron, yeah. like that's his number one.
Yeah, I get that. And I think The Abyss, both the praise I'd give it and the biggest criticism I'd level towards it is, I think this is maybe the first movie he made where the technology and the drive to do something extraordinary and different in film is what drove him to make the movie versus the story.
Yes.
It felt like the story came second. It felt like he was yes. like, I want to make an underwater movie. I want to push this to a whole new place. And I feel like that's where the seed was planted, like with The Abyss. I feel like with Aliens, Terminator, and Terminator 2, the plots and the epic story and effects kind of meld a little bit better. The Abyss is effective, it's emotional, and it's stronger than Titanic or Avatar or when he gives into like his worst tendencies later on in his career.
Yeah.
But I do feel like maybe this is where the seed was planted, where he started to say, you know what, I just want to push the envelope and I'll come up with the script later.
Right, exactly. And I mean, most films, I mean, they have that seed. Like, is it Jaws? Is it based off a book? Or is it, you know, and I think he said it like this, it's like it really drills down at the end into two people in a tin can at the bottom of the ocean, like that, which is why that's yeah. probably the best scene of the whole movie. That is the core, and everything else, everything leading up to it and everything after is literally off of that core.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I mean, that's what Cameron does really well. At his best, Cameron captures the humanity in the midst of all this chaos and all this insanity, all these effects. You get these very, very human emotional stories and relationships that I think that's why, I mean, that's why he is the most, he's made the most profitable films of all time, because he can
right.
tap into that part of the general populace and people connect to it and people really respond to it. I think it's a shame that The Abyss has kind of been shoved aside in his filmography, because I think it's worthy of everyone's attention. I mean, if people listening to this haven't
seen it. I mean, if they ever did a Cameron box set, I don't see how you could not include it.
No, and you should. And I hope someday it can kind of be seen with more appreciative eyes. I feel like I'm glad we got to do this episode, because it allowed me the opportunity to look at it with fresh eyes and see it, and to give us a chance to talk about it. And I do hope it doesn't feel like, no one is knocking The Abyss. No one is saying it's a bad movie, but it would be nice to kind of see it, maybe, especially in light of Avatar 2 supposedly taking place like in underwater.
If it's underwater, you know they're going to start making the comparisons.
Exactly.
Like,
so I feel like The Abyss may start to get its due a little bit more than it even has at this point. But I guess if we're going to rate it on a scale of 1 to 5
miles down.
Yeah. 1 to 5 miles down. 1 to 5 pantyhose miles down.
Oh, jeez. How many pantyhose, please? It's the worst line in the whole movie.
How many miles down would you give it?
Well, I have to give it, you said 1 to 5?
Yeah, 1 to 5, 5 being the highest.
I have to give it a 5. I mean, I've told people many times, and they'll look at me because they don't know what this movie is, you know, that this, I would often state this is my favorite film over Star Wars, over others. Mm. It may not be the best film, but I love it. I love the characters. I love the effects work. I love the miniatures. I love the story. I love the acting. I love the subs. I just love that this was made, that this is something that Cameron pulled into existence through a lot of determination and just made this happen, because like I've said before, I don't think this movie could be made by anyone else at any other time in history, you know, anywhere else in the world. You just either wouldn't fund it, you would choose not to do it, or you would not make it as good. Everything came together at this moment, and it was really difficult.
Yeah.
Which is another reason why you wouldn't do it again. But so yeah, I give it five miles down. What about you?
I completely agree. I think this is absolutely unmistakably James Cameron, and you couldn't have made it at any other time. I'd probably give it a 3 out of 5. I enjoyed it. I do think like we talked about, the plot, it's a little too all over the place for me. It doesn't coalesce as well, but man, when the movie works, it really works. And there's so much here to admire and so much here to really, it's jaw-dropping. And I loved, like I said, there's some beautiful, beautiful, very human moments. I think it was just the combination of the very, like, kind of sporadic, all over the place plotting, and then the ending I thought was a little goofy with the whole, like, we need to learn to be better and war is bad.
Yeah.
But
you know, it's interesting, I was thinking, because I was trying to think of ways to make the end not so goofy, and what they could have done is instead of the NTIs, which you would have lost the water tentacle and some other things, or you still could have had that, it's like, what's this random stuff at the bottom of the ocean, but what if you actually had, like, some prototype Russian sub did take out the Montana, and they are down there, and so it's becomes a choice of not killing our sworn enemy.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you could still make it a little more human. I don't know. Everything's so interwoven. It's hard to pull the
third
act out.
I love the supernatural element. I love, you know, just the alien element is great, but it's like there's one thing too many, and it's like, do you take out the military subplot? Do you take out
military?
Do you take out the alien? I feel like leave the aliens, leave it fantastical and otherworldly, but like something else has got to go. But there should have been something just to bring it more into focus in that third act. I think it would have helped the movie tremendously. But I think it's good. I think it deserves to be part of the conversation as far as Cameron's movies. And I hope, like we were saying, when Avatar 2 comes out, maybe that'll bring this movie back out of the depths and allow people to appreciate it in a whole new way with its anniversary, its 30th anniversary coming up.
Exactly. I gotta imagine, with it being an anniversary year and with you know, interest in Avatar 2 coming out, it's got to happen.
I mean, we got to get that Blu-ray.
I want to see these effects in Blu-ray so bad. Because you know what? Because there's something about when you... Okay, we watched episode 1 the other night, and there's definitely some parts where the CGI does not hold up. It just, in HD, that's the hardest thing to maintain, you know, 10, 20 years later. I have a feeling that almost every single shot in this movie is going to hold up on Blu-ray.
Oh yeah, I'm. There's a 4K of this. I think I may have to pick it up. I will make that happen. But yeah, that's great. So that's The Abyss for you. And I'm so excited, Darren, that you could be a part of this. Thank you so much for the excuse to watch The Abyss. I'm glad we got to chat about it. This is fantastic.
Oh, thanks for having me on. Yeah, you really had to twist my arm to watch my favorite film with someone who's a Cameron lover who had never seen it.
I know.
And we get to geek out over film. I mean, this is great. So hopefully we'll be able to find something else that I have not seen.
Definitely. We'll turn the tables a bit, and you can tear apart a movie that I love. Get some revenge. But thank you to our audience for listening. And if you're checking this out somewhere where you can rate us, give us a 5-star rating. It gives us a little boost. Share it with your friends who you think might like it. And again, follow us. I'm at Yay Chandraman on Twitter. I want to hear some stuff about James Cameron. Do you like James Cameron? What do you think of him? And find Darren as well. Darren, can people find you on Twitter? On the Twitter?
Yeah, on the Twitter, yes, they can find me again 5 miles down on Twitter under username Dr. Sci-Fi, DrSciFi, also on Instagram and my website, drsci-fi.com. So a little more Star Wars, Star Trek-y right now, but I'm always open for talking miniature effects and hole crushing implosion scenes.
Yeah, and that sounds, I mean, again, these are, Darren does a ton of podcasts and they're all fantastic. And
That's true. You can catch me at City Alpha 3 here on the Nerd Party Network. I should mention that.
You should. Yeah, you should. How dare you? But you can also follow the Nerd Party at Join Nerd Party on Twitter. You can like the Facebook page and keep up with all the cool stuff we're doing. Tons of great stuff on there. And this has been a great episode. I think we successfully managed to hold on to our pantyhose. So everyone have a wonderful whatever.
Here's a bottomless movie, baby.